well, Jerry, how's it going?
It's going great. It's going great, Dave. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, listen, let's just take a look at where we are now with David Bowie. Like, this weekend there's a big compilation released again of a lot of his old stuff, etc. It goes back 50 years this time, because who knew he recorded his first thing in 1960, bleeding four, so long ago. But anyway, that's the way it is. It's looked on 50 years. What are you over the last 15 years or so? Do we go back to 1997 to take a look, first of all? And people always say, Jerry Leonard, musical director. Are you David Bowie's musical director? Director, and if so, what the hell does that mean?
Yes, exactly. Like, it's like trying to direct traffic, you know. Well, you know, what happened was that when I first started playing with David, there was a friend of mine who was his musical director, a guy called Mark Platy, who was a producer engineer, who did the Earthling record and various other records with David. And he left. He got me involved in the band, and then he had to leave for another project. So he kind of handed that over to me, and that was more or less when we were doing the reality tour,
yeah.
Which was like a year long tour of a lot of production. It was a DVD and a show, and you know, we ended up learning 64 songs. He needed a point person in the band to go and say, okay, here's what we're gonna do, and then it was my job to go back to the band and, you know, all the sound crew and everything like that, and kind of go like, okay, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, but isn't a lot of it has to do with the stuff in the past? You've just mentioned 64 songs you had to learn, and like Robert Fripp would have done stuff on albums, Adrian Belew would have done stuff on albums. They weren't around to do stuff whatever now. So did you have to kind of learn their bits, if you like, particularly learn their bits to play them live?
Yes, that was why, you know, they got me kind of involved in the first place. They needed the kind of out of the box guitar player to come in and cover all the Robert Fripp and the Adrian Belews and, you know, the more kind of like weird stuff that was the Eno-esque stuff that was always going on. You know, I got a reputation for myself for, you know, fiddling around with boxes and guitars and, you know, the weirder side of things, the squawks and the squeals, and then the kind of like the beautiful Eno-esque kind of
exactly. And you were kind of the expert in this kind of thing. So like, he went to look at you in a tiny little club somewhere in the East Village or something like that, about 50 people there, and he kind of goes, okay, David Bowie's sitting there going, this is the guy I want, Jerry Leonard. Now, has any of that at all to do, Jerry, not so much of what you did before in terms of bands you might have played at night here on the radio, demo tapes, etc., or Kissing the Roof of Heaven or all that kind of stuff? Was it like to do with the 5 years at the Municipal College of Music in Dublin learning classical, and you were able to experiment during those years?
Yeah, you know, when I got to New York, there was 100 guys. You know, I found that as a guitar player, you know, I wanted to try and work on the scene, but there was a lot of guys there, and I decided to just kind of like figure out like what I was best at, like where, you know, what were the things that added up,
yeah,
to make me what I was. And I was doing that, and my solo thing called Spooky Ghost was a thing that I used to play out in a coffee shop, Chine, you know, the little 50 seater coffee house. And you know, he came down to check me out doing that exactly, Dave, and that was the thing.
But like, I mean, like when you say Spooky Ghost, I mean, it was Donald Coughlin, your other half in Hinterland, that might have called that Spooky Ghost. Spooky Ghost was almost like a kind of, how shall I put this? It was a descriptive term for the kind of looping and textures that you became proficient at.
Exactly. It was Donald Coughlin coined that phrase, and I ended up using it for my solo thing, Spooky Ghost. You know, we went through the 90s with sequencers and playing to click tracks and thinking that was all really cool. And I figured out that it was, you know, there was something there, but it was nicer to try and do it live. It made it you know, that's what I do a lot now is you know, I play this stuff live as we're playing, and I'm out with Suzanne Vega right now, and there's times where there's when I'll do a song where there's three or four times when I'll loop something and erase it and re-loop it and play over it. So it's become a kind of second language for me. But I think with David, he needed that. He definitely needed somebody to be able to interpret all those textures and stuff. And I fought hard on the gig to play the stuff live and not have it kind of like piped down some kind of like little headphones.
Sure, but hold on. Here's the bit I don't get, because I didn't see you doing this stuff live. You do whatever. It goes down really well in Berlin or whatever. And David comes out and says, hey, I'll tell you what, we'll just do an encore. Let's do Low. Now, Low is one of the three famous kind of Berlin albums. And you do the whole lot of look. I mean, like, seriously, if you look at the vinyl of Low, side one and side two, are you telling me that you could just get up there on stage and like almost suddenly, regardless of how much homework you had done, be confronted with the fact that you're going to have to do all of side two of Low? And like, it's Mr. Loop Central, that's you. I mean, like, that's Brian Eno. You were doing all that. Like, were you okay with that, or was that totally seat of the pants?
Well, we had rehearsed it, and that helped, you know?
Of course.
And to do it live like that was you know, it was great to be able to drag it out of the closet and go, yeah, we've done this and we can do this and here it is. I had to build a specific guitar rig to do this stuff with David, where I had a lot of stuff on recall, you know, so that I could, you know, before it wasn't exactly like I had just a pedal board in front of me where I had a bunch of stomp boxes. I had some pretty sophisticated stuff available to recall. But nonetheless, we knew it, and it was great fun. We all laughed when David said, oh, yeah, let's do Low as the encore. I mean, the audience went bonkers, but the band was also kind of like, we can do this. And it was an amazing band.
I mean, like, songs like, you know, The Superman, Gone Back to 70 or something, of The Man Who Sold the World, and stuff like, you know, Station to Station 5 or 6 years later, or The Bewley Brothers in between from his best album, Hunky Dory. All those things you could do off the drop of a hat, could you?
Yeah. He was on a real roll that time. We were playing 3 hours to start off with.
Yeah.
And he kept adding songs as we toured. You know, we toured for that year. He would call me up and say, I want to do this song. Let's do this song. He had this running joke that Bob Dylan had like 80 songs or something in his catalog, and we were up to 64, and we were like, come on, let's keep going. Let's keep just keep learning these songs. So we kept adding songs, and so we had a lot of songs. You know, at that point, we had a lot of songs available, not including you know, all those songs that we wanted him to play that he would never play. We did a version of Win, and it was beautiful. And,
Win is from the Young American albums, from the Young Americans album. So all those ones, we say 70 to 76, they're like the golden age of Bowie, that's fine. But would it be fair to say that even if he does do, particularly maybe in Australia or something, Let's Dance and that kind of thing, that the Let's Dance stuff, no matter how famous it was later and kept him going in a total third phase of his career, is it fair to say that he wouldn't have liked that stuff as much as the stuff I just mentioned earlier on?
Yeah, he was more excited when we did stuff like Bewley Brothers or
Bewley Brothers and Quicksand. It doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, and Fantastic Journey. You know, that stuff. Let's Dance. It's hard to step away from the hits, you know, for anybody, including a David Bowie. And I think when we went to territories that we hadn't, you know, where he hadn't been in many, many years, like Down Under, like Australia.
He had to play stuff like that,
He understood that people wanted to hear Let's Dance.
Well, then let's take a look at him now from 10 years ago. This is 2014, and 10 years ago, and by 2004, like, I mean, you were everywhere with him at this stage, and had toured enough and been on stage, and as I say, musical director, etc. Like, I mean, by June 2004, he was complaining of chest pains, and he kind of went off the radar then completely after that. I think you guys at first didn't realise how serious this was, and we're talking about a blocked artery and a stint, etc. And the final German show, you probably remember well. Do you remember? Wasn't there a gig in Oslo where a Korean girl trying to be nice threw a lollipop, hit him in the eye? Was that the beginning of some kind of thing where he was freaking out, or was that just a one-off incident?
You know, that was a one-off, Dave. It was an odd, weird thing, and I believe that might have been the only gig where we played Space Odyssey, for instance, which was one of our songs that we love to do. And but there was some girl, yeah, it's a sign of affection, I guess, in Korea to throw candy at the person that you like, and this one was a bullseye, and it was just, you know, somebody throws something in your eye, and it's kind of like what just happened. It was totally unrelated. I was on stage with him in Prague. We played four songs, and he walked past me, he walked off stage, and I was like, that's not supposed to happen.
That was the gig. We did a few kind of like instrumentally stuff and saying, what's going to happen? Is he coming back on? He did come back on, didn't he?
He came back on. We you know, he walked off, and we played a couple of instrumentals, and we came back on, and we did Station to Station, and then he really was feeling terrible, so we had to cancel the show. It happened right there on stage, but that's showbiz. It's just what happens. You know?
Okay, well then, the 10 years ago, as I mentioned, the blocked artery, the stent, all the rest of it, and that's the 10 years, the final German show, etc. Nothing then till, like, you know, nothing happens until you literally get a dumb email, like, don't mention a word, here's an email, what are you up to, Jerry, we need you. This is November 2010, exactly 4 years ago. So you went and what, just made demo tapes, and that was it? That could have been shelved in the same way as the Toy album was, you know, 12, 13 years ago.
That was my big concern, exactly that, Dave. He sent me an email, the title Stom, don't tell anybody, come down. And it was very David. You know, he likes to do things in a very old-fashioned way. He had a notebook and he had a book bag and he had some demo tapes, some little demo tapes that he'd done on like a 4-track. And we got in the room and we just banged out these new songs. And it started the process. I mean, first of all, it was great to see him want to work again and to do something again. And I could tell that he was testing the waters for himself and the songs. So we were very tuned into that, and we just, you know, put our heads down and really tried to do the best work we could, because we felt like, well, I felt if we do this well, maybe it'll keep going. That was the surprise for everybody. But all through that process, and it was very stop-start for almost 2 years. And all along, even when he'd played me partial mixes, I kept thinking, is this record going to go away the way that the other records have gone away? David has, you know, he's a very good editor, and he may decide to just edit this and put it on the shelf. So we were really worried about that. Thankfully, we got the call to say, oh, well, I found out the same way as everybody else did. He just popped it out on his birthday 2 years ago.
Okay, and then, like, you know, you were there, like, just, you know, doing whatever it is with Visconti and all the rest of it in the East Village and that. And it was great fun, and he was in great form, I presume, making the album that came out last year.
Yeah, he was really in good form. He was really excited to be working, and you could tell, like, I would get to the studio, he was already there making his notes, and he was just really, really beaming.
And does he work in an old-fashioned way? When you say making notes, are we talking about a jotter and a biro, are we? You're not exactly online stuff.
I think the American version, I've learned to speak both languages now, Dave. I can say aluminum and aluminium.
Can you now?
I can. He had a legal pad.
Right.
And a pen. They don't know what a biro is, but
no.
It was, yeah, it's a jotter and a biro, a line, you know, page, and, you know, you scribble it down, and you make your notes, and you know, you do it that way. It's not all this kind of like MP3 this and...
No, of course, yeah.
You know,
Pro Tools,
laptop.
That,
here's my plug-in, my David Bowie plug-in, that already cuts up the lyrics.
Well, look, you're...
drives them around the room.
You're doing, what did you say at the moment? It's Suzanne Vega. And you've done in the past Cyndi Lauper and Avril Lavigne and Rufus Wainwright and Sophie B. Hawkins, even Roger Waters. You did some stuff, didn't you? And by the way, David Bowie, he won't be representing England in the Eurovision next year, will he? You're not still doing that, are you?
Well, we're working on the song. It's taken a while.
Are you
it's
now?
Really a whopper.
Yeah, I'm really glad I asked that. Shut up, for God's sake, Jerry. Okay, listen, just one other thing, by the way, just going right back with you to Dublin. I mean, when we're talking about Lombard Studios and that, you were like, you know, looking at tapes and working things out and recording, etc., even like, well, you know, being in a band or not being in a band or playing guitar or not playing guitar. Did you record the very first Sinead O'Connor demo when she was only 15 or 16?
Well, I recorded Sinead for a demo for Into a Nua.
I remember
the band Into a Nua.
They
did some demos with Sinead O'Connor sang two and Leslie Faddle sang two.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things. Leslie ended up in the band and Sinead went on to do, you know, the amazing things that she did. So, yeah, she was real young. She came in and sang. I was a junior engineer down in Lombard, and we used to get the studio at weekends to do bands. We did country and western, and we did all the show bands, and we did all the jingles during the Monday to Friday. But those guys all had gigs at weekends, so the studio was dark from 7 p.m. on Friday till Monday at 8 a.m. And guess who was in there in those hours?
Right, indeed,
making the Vinyl Verdict album.
All right, okay. Well, isn't this, Jerry, finally then, just David Bowie, anything else coming up in the future, or are you still musical director, or are you just wait for this stum email? Sorry, the stum phone call, probably.
You know, I gotta go check my emails, Dave.
Really?
You know, I really should.
Yeah, like you're going to tell me. Listen, Jerry, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a million for talking to us about David Bowie. Thanks very much, Jerry.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
All right, come on, Jerry. Take it easy. Bye.
Okay.
Jerry Leonard, it was there that we just spoke to on the phone. It's now 29 minutes to midday where Larry takes over for lunchtime. So there's more David Bowie to come now. And what we're going to do is just sort of look through a lot of the interviews that I did in the past and stick them all together in a kind of a strange way. But just before we do, nothing has changed that the definitive collection of Bowie's music from 64 to 2014 features some previously unreleased material, but of course all the huge big hits as well. Three copies of the 3-CD deluxe edition of Nothing Has Changed to give away right now in the programme. We'll have three winners before the end of the programme. So what you have to do is, and you this isn't necessarily that easy, even if you check it up. Anyway, David Bowie formed his first professional band at the age of 15. What was the name of the band? If you know, 51552, with your name and address, three winners is what we're talking about here. Nothing has changed. It's the very best of Bowie that we're looking at. Now, what I'm going to look at here is just go back and stick bits and pieces together of interviews. So, he'd be talking about Tin Machine, which is the band that a lot of people didn't like very much, but he did, about writing, about the Lindsay Kemp stuff and the mime stuff in the 60s. You hear him from Elephant Man on stage, and then it takes a look at some of the movies he's done with Jeff Goldblum, Into the Night, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. The character he loved most was the Blue Jean character in the video of that, where he played the nerd. The Hunger with Susan Sarandon, which he didn't think was great. I did think that was good, actually. Then Ziggy Stardust, Ashes to Ashes. He talks about his dreams and about creating characters and who he was influenced by and who he influences and all the rest, and even a funny little Elvis Presley story. Anyway, that's what we're going to do next and take a listen to all this. So I'm going to delve right in, and the first thing you'll hear is me from some time back. Let's go for it. This is a special David Bowie.
You've always switched styles and always switched moods, but I mean, the way you're switching lately, it just seems so effortless. Now, is it? Is it just a natural thing for you, or do you have to work at it?
No. I think because my interests were always in, at any given time, were in new music. My collection, it just looks like some bizarre, relic-oriented scrapyard of everything from industrial to old Harry Parch stuff from California, legendary Stardust Cowboy, Wild Man Fisher. I mean, it's got the most bizarre things in throughout the years, and those are the things that I listen to.
There's no way David Bowie wants to work with a safety net, if you like, absolutely.
Not really, because when I've endeavoured to do that, I've just felt that the most dissatisfied creatively as I ever could feel, and I really felt that I was just destroying everything that I thought worthwhile in my work, and I felt really disappointed in myself. I thought that I was letting myself down and letting my work down, and I would have quit. I really would have quit. I think I really would have gone back to just sort of, you know, immersing myself in the visual arts. It was it seemed at one time a real easy decision, you know. Here I was making lots of money, performing to these huge audiences and thoroughly uncomfortable and unhappy with life. And I was getting more enjoyment out of just being back in the the painting studio and all that. And I thought, well, why bother? You know, I've got nothing left that really I've that's it, you know, I've come to the vacuum of my life. And I guess, you see, I was around 40. So, you know, looking back on it, one also wonders if it wasn't sort of the inevitable midlife crisis, right, yeah, as well. Yeah. Because it all happened in my sort of 40 to 44 period. I tried, you know, so hard to feel okay with it all, but it was just obvious to me that it was all going incredibly wrong. So I was about to give up, and if it hadn't have been for Reeves Gabrels, my guitar player,
right,
I probably would have. But he was, he's such an unquenchable, pithy, witty, intelligent lad. And he said, well, there is a second option, and that is you just completely back off everything you're doing and just try doing all the things that you used to enjoy, the reason that you started doing music in the first place. And the result of that, of course, was Tin Machine, which I know it's hard to believe, but it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me in that way. Mm. There were 4 years. It wasn't an overnight band either.
No.
We were together for 4 years. It was a long period. Most bands are together less than that and they, yeah, break up, you know. We really stuck it out. And in that period, I think I relearned what it was to write for myself, not try and meet an audience's expectations. And that really set me back on the path of what I like doing.
When you always decide to go out on tour, you have to come up with something very different. So this time around, how involved...
Well, I don't have to.
Well, I mean, you always want to.
I push myself into, yeah, it, because I really, I mean, it's... I've always had this problem, is that I was never happy as just a singer, you know, because, yeah, I never really was that confident in my own abilities as just a singer, that it would be at all interesting to anybody at all. So I thought that I wanted to establish myself as a theatrical entity, as I derive so much satisfaction from going to the theatre or to, yeah, go and watch dance, that it would be great to be able to combine that feeling with the rock music that I'd live with and really wanted to play and write.
The late 60s were great for people like me, because it was the era of multimedia shows and great music going on, and Atlanta was full of mime companies, the best of which was a group of mimes called the Lindsay Kemp Company, who were very fundamental in teaching me quite a bit about stage work, stage craft, how lighting worked, how you could use your body on stage and make a dramatic statement. Always sort of thought that theatre was about props and things, when it's not at all. I mean, I hopefully could do any of the shows that I have done without any of the scenery or props that I've used, because a lot of it was body work, how the body language, how the body moves and what statements it can make on stage. And I kind of got all that from the Lindsay Kemp Company.
I don't know why I look like this, Mrs. Kemp. My mother was so beautiful. She was knocked down by an elephant in the circus while she was pregnant. Something must have happened, don't you think?
A favourite role is a little tiny thing, cameo role that I did for John Landis in a movie called Into the Night, where John gave me complete freedom to sort of play it up.
What are you talking about?
Okay. I represent Monsieur Mavie, and I can assure you that he can be far more reasonable than the savant.
The savant?
The Shell secret, please. This one. Iranian Gestapo. Shaheen's boys.
Shaheen's boys.
I thank you, Ed. I do like you. You're very good. The Stones.
Why?
Where are the Stones?
I can't help you.
We do understand each other, don't we?
The
other one that I got complete freedom on was the Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which is a performance I don't think was as successful, but it was certainly a great thing to do. Most like me, I suppose, the nerd in blue jean.
Hello. I'm not alone.
Is he big?
Very big.
Well, that's all right. He'll like me. Lots of people like me. Well, not straight away, but I've been a couple of minutes since, have we? No, we haven't. Met before.
The least like me, I guess, I hope, anyway, is The Hunger. I felt very uncomfortable with that role, although I loved being involved in a Tony Scott movie.
You know, John speaks before he thinks.
Is that what he does? I can't figure him out.
Please, play the Lola for me, even if it is a little saccharine.
Are you sure you're not John's father?
Quite sure.
If you go back to the early images of all the fun, say, oh, Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust and the whole lot, I mean, was that sort of trying to exorcise some ghosts within you in some ways?
I think...
Being afraid to be David Bowie.
A lot of those times, I guess, was a way of making up a pastiche of myself. Maybe a lot of it was just sort of exaggerations of some finer points of how I thought, or not quite so fine ways of the way I thought. I think I blew those out of context and made them sort of cartoon figures of how I was thinking at the time.
Do you see much in today's modern music that's still David Bowie? I mean, obviously it was there in the late 70s, obviously there was the early 80s, but what about now?
What do you mean? The actuality that there's...
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I find it... sometimes very flattering and sometimes a bit disheartening, depends which band it is, but a lot of bands that took influence, but I think it's all hybrids and amalgamations of bands, you know. I don't think that any of us were ever one single influence. There was myself, Iggy, Roxy Music, T-Rex. I mean, we all put in our two cents and produced all this kind of stuff, this porridge of sound and look.
Inspiration come from these days?
I think I turned inwards a lot more then. I thought I would try and be once upon a time I'd try and be a lot more objective and almost cold in my sensitivities or sensibilities as to what was happening outside of me, and I would establish some kind of impressionistic point of view of what was happening almost from a detached kind of level. I was always very seriously affected by my dreams. The dream state seemed to be so potently full of images and weaknesses and strengths that I felt were contained within myself. It came through art as well. When I started seeing things like movies by Salvador Dali and Buñuel and work by De Chirico, I said, yes, that's exactly how my dreams felt. That's how I want to write, or how do you work like that? And then I started reading people like William Burroughs. I started learning about the cut-up techniques that they employed to create new ways of thinking. And I thought I'd try and apply that to writing. So that's kind of how it evolved. It was a question of creating characters up until about 1976. And at that point, when I started working with Brian Eno, my emphasis changed from creating characters for stage, but actually really getting involved in finding out more about music. I I tend to write from what's happening within myself. So it's a lot more subjective, I think, than it used to be.
So is it a lot more personal then as
yes,
well?
Yes, it is, actually, yeah.
Do you think in some ways that getting married, do you think that's actually made you a better person towards appreciating other people, if you like? That maybe you've even got more real friends now than you did maybe 20 years ago.
I'm not sure which, if it's chicken or egg.
Yeah.
I think probably I couldn't have carried out this relationship and continued it if I hadn't have been in a place where I was ready for a real long-lasting relationship with somebody. So I had changed. I mean, I've been changing over the last 10 years. Always the chameleon.
Hey.
I guess I just got more. I probably had a greater grasp on the reality of what my life had become and what I wanted my life to become. So I knew that I really was looking for some kinds of emotional stabilities, you know. So I was in a good place when we met for that. And I guess the reciprocal love between us has kind of just kept me extremely buoyant about life. And I'm in love still. I mean, you know, it's as simple as that. I think being in love has an awful lot to do with it.
What about that last Spider tour when he brought it to Slane?
It's really difficult because it's as new to me as it is to everybody else. I mean, the complexity of the thing is really quite extraordinary. Just getting the thing from one place to another, and then getting everything set up in time. And as far as being on stage, it's a most peculiar feeling to be doing something quite so theatrical in front of such large audiences. But over the last week or so, it's been quite fantastic.
Well, when you say quite so theatrical, are you talking about, like, just the actual sort of setup of the whole thing in terms of what it incorporates and what does it incorporate?
Not in terms of just special effects or something, you know, because it doesn't actually revolve around special effects. The physicality of what happens on stage has become the focus point for me, the complexity of that physicality. There's an awful lot of modern dance involved in it. So the concentration is within ourselves on stage, whereas on a stadium thing, you usually exert a lot of energy outwards to the audience itself. But when a lot of the energy is reverting backwards and forwards between the actors and the dancers, in that way, it becomes a completely different kind of feeling. And one feels that a lot of that is broadcast out on the screens that we use. It's a novel situation.
Well, when you say modern dance music, I mean, are you talking about sort of like American street dance, hip-hop type stuff almost?
The two areas I wanted to explore were that very aspect, and also modern European dance. And there's the kinds of dancing that we're using are not explored at all on things like videos or MTV. Dance haven't really been seen in the rock and roll context, which I think makes it kind of unique.
Well, I get the impression of what you just said then, that you have kept up your interest in dance in terms of the old days of the Beckenham Arts Lab.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I think it's great. I love exciting new kind. And the new wave of dancing at the moment is very savage, and it does owe a lot to street dance. That's why the people that I auditioned for, the little troupe that I put together, I didn't want trained dancers or kind of, you know, those faggy kind of guys you get on Hollywood or something. So, like, one of our guys is an ex-gang leader. Another one was, very strangely, as a savage punk who used to be a boy in a bubble, which is the most peculiar thing. Lived for the first 6 years of his life in that situation, has developed this strange flipping thing from watching television when he was a kid and having to reply to the television by learning to flip. He worked with several people in areas of modern dance that you may well have had over here. I don't know if you ever had Momix.
No.
Dance company, experimental dance company from California. Well, they worked with us on a lot of the situations. From them, we took the idea of using skis and having dancings performed on skis, which are quite peculiar.
Made you turn away from drugs then? Is this like spirituality that you had to find? Is that the route you take? Some people do to get into it, sort of back to a normal life.
Firstly, physically, I was painfully emancipated. Emaciated, rather. Emancipated came later. Emaciated. I was just not even skin and bone. I was just bone. I was bone with these veins wrapped around them. I mean, I was the most, oh, God knows what weight I was, but I was way below, like, I think at some points I almost reached like 80 pounds, you know. It's just really, really painful. And also my disposition was left a lot to be desired. I was just paranoid, manic depressive. It was all this usual emotional paraphernalia that comes with abuse of amphetamines and cokes and all that.
Okay, if you go back to your 20s and you're driven and you're now...
Who wants to go back to
No, sorry, your 20s in age, but not, and now it's the 90s and you're 50 years of age now and you're driven. What's the difference between the two drivens?
I think the earlier one was a dry... I have a drive now. I'm not sure that I'm driven. It's different. I have a motor which works at a 24-hour length. Yeah. I'm very aware of the day that I'm living through now. I'm very happy about being in the now in that way. It sounds very neo-Buddhistic, but it's true. I feel very content with what I do on each day as it happens. But I think when I was in my 20s, I was always looking to the next thing. Yeah. I wasn't enjoying recording. I'd make records, but I was thinking about what the show would look like and where that and what we could do with that. And I was always three steps ahead of myself. So I never enjoyed process.
Yeah.
But now I really enjoy making an album and then actually doing the tour and enjoying the performances, you know. Right. And that's a different kind of feeling entirely. It's still there, the enthusiasm, but it's not so ambition-driven.
The press release says something along the lines of, like, you have a fascination with living in the spectre of imminent apocalypse.
He was Ziggy. He was the thin white joke.
Chameleon
of rock.
The point about it is, I mean, surely, since, like, 2 years before you were born, they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. So surely imminent apocalypse is every day of the week since 1945.
Of course, the day I was born, apparently, according to the great tome that came out a couple of years ago, Jackson Pollock did his first... dribble painting.
Great. There you go. What does that tell
us? That was apocalyptic in itself. Apocalyptic, you know? I mean, look what that did.
The day you were born is the same day as Elvis. Did that mean anything to you? Or did it...
Well, being an elitist, I much prefer the Jackson Pollock connection.
Yeah, right. Very good.
But yeah, I mean, of course, when I was a kid, the idea that Elvis and my cousin was in love with Elvis, Christina, and she had all those early 78s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like most girls at that particular time. And she was, like, so happy that my birthday was the same as his. She said, oh, there's a family connection. So I was, like, 7 or 8 and having this put in my head. So it probably did awfully perverse things to me. I thought, well, oh, I better be the British Elvis then.
Right, cool.
Well, obviously, then, I've got no choice.
Okay, well, then going back then to the Pinnacle of Planets that we were talking about earlier on, did you actually go to an Elvis gig at Madison Square Gardens
dressed as
Ziggy?
Yes.
Come on, you sat in the front row.
That's absolutely right. And I got I got there late.
Really?
Ziggy's
coming in here.
It was awful. Well, of course, I was totally unknown in the States. This was pre any kind of knowledge about me in the States.
This would be a hunky-dory 70 direction.
Yeah, a little bit later than that. I was pretty much there with the short cropped hair and the platform, the Kansai platform boots and all that. And I remember getting there late because my plane was on time, but the show was also on time. We thought it might be delayed or something, just because shows are usually rock shows. We didn't realise how professional and showbiz the whole thing was. And I got in there and started walking down the aisle, and I wished the earth would just open and swallow me. I thought, why did I get here late? And he didn't give me a ticket off or anything. I'm not sure. I know that he saw me coming in and... that he didn't make any comment.
But I mean, was he dressed in his sort of Las Vegas-y kind of hamburger?
No, it wasn't
vibes?
Quite. It hadn't got to that hadn't full that bad, kind yeah. of ostentation. It was midway between the Las Vegas and the black leather.
Yeah.
So he was. He looked still looked pretty funky. He looked pretty good, and he was thin and just looked. Remember, he was only like 30 years old. He was still pretty incredible.
Yeah,
you know, it was like, wow, that is Elvis, you know, up there, sort of about 20 yards away, you know. Yeah. It was an incredible thing to see. It was an incredible thing to see.